It's 2:06, and we're glad you're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George, filling in this afternoon for Bill Nigut, who's taking a well-deserved vacation. He'll be back with you in 2 weeks, and I'll be here with you today, next Monday, next Wednesday, and next Friday. We're glad you're here as well. If you're listening on GPB Radio or watching us on Facebook, you can watch us live on the GPB News Facebook page, and you can also send your feedback to us on Twitter. We're at PoliticsGPB on Twitter. Joining us today, Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, longtime Republican insider Loretta Lepore, former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden, and joining us from NPR in Washington, it's Kyle Hayes, the founder and host of Peach Pod, a Georgia politics podcast. Kyle, we're glad you're with us.
Yeah, it's great to be back with y'all.
And thanks to our panel as well for being here today. So we're going to start talking about immigration. Of course, lots of news there the government and groups that work with immigrant families are trying to undo this humanitarian and bureaucratic mess that was created by these family separations along the border. And along with that, Jim, we have some new wrinkles in attempts to pass some kind of immigration bill in the House.
Right. On Thursday, House Republicans took up the most conservative version of an immigration bill. It refused any path to citizenship for Dreamers. But it would allow them some sort of a certificate that would allow them to reside in the United States. It failed pretty substantially. There was a second moderate bill that was being put together by Paul Ryan. The first one, by the way, got the votes of all but one Republican from Georgia, Drew Ferguson.
That's right.
But, Jim, 41 Republicans nationwide voted against it.
Right, exactly. And so, but the next one, the Paul Ryan one, was supposed to be more moderate. They got to the floor, realized they didn't have the votes. They have postponed it once to today. They've postponed it again till tomorrow or till next week. And then in the meantime, you have this Morning Post from Donald Trump kind of sabotaging the whole affair, saying, let's have no more votes on immigration until after November, after the midterms.
Let me read what the president said. Republicans should stop wasting their time on immigration until after we elect more senators and congressmen and women in November. Dems are just playing games, have no intention of doing anything to solve this decades-old problem. The president said, we can pass great legislation after the red wave. Loretta Lepore, do you think this is something that Republicans should wait and see how their fortunes turn out in November to try to pass something?
I think there are some Republicans in moderate districts that need to have a vote on this alternative legislation. They need to let their constituents know that they did try to reach some type of agreement on the Dreamers specifically and what kind of status the Dreamers will have in this country moving forward. And so for that reason, the alternative immigration bill ought to move forward. And there's no guarantee that the dynamics will shift on this. I mean, we've been dealing with this issue in the previous administration as well. So there's no guarantee that after the midterms that the dynamics would be any different.
Kyle, you're in D.C. What do you know about the dynamics right now?
Well, I think the thing that's interesting is the discussion around here in D.C. seemed to be that the executive order from the president solved this problem. And I don't think that it actually does that. The president or the administration is now moving from wanting to separate parents and children to wanting to detain them together indefinitely while their court case moves through the courts. And that's in violation of a court settlement from the 1990s that sets some standards for how you can detain children and some standards for what's needed when you do that.
Kyle, this is Buddy. I'm down here with a copy of the executive order in front of me, and you're absolutely right. And what he's attempting to do is to somehow get a modification of the Flores case, which was decided some time ago, which is highly unlikely. But as you suggest, the order really doesn't do anything.
Right. And the important thing is that even if they won the right by changing that settlement or having Congress do a fix to basically override that court settlement, then the outcome that you get to is sort of indefinite detention while these cases move through the courts, which can take months or years. And I think there's going to be less standards there for the quality of care that children get when they're in the custody of the federal government in detention.
But correct me if I'm mistaken, but we're talking about two different things here. So the more moderate compromise bill, as it's being called, on immigration, doesn't really address the current border issue. And there is separate legislation on that. Am I correct on that?
I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah. So it's mm-hmm. we're talking about two separate bills. And so there's one in the Senate that, I mean, Ted Cruz has put forward one. Both Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue have signed on to a bill in the Senate.
Several Republicans that would, in the Senate have signed
yeah,
on
that would address yeah. the issue on the border, that a current issue on the border. The legislation pending in the House is more of a long-term dealing with the wall, Dreamers, what kind of status they should have, whether it should be a path to citizenship or just a legal status, and some other issues, but not directly related to the issue on the border with the children.
But we should be clear, though, these are Republican bills, and Democrats so far have not shown very much interest in supporting any of them.
No, Bradley, let me talk about that just for a second, because I think here's a fallacy in the entire Republican approach. They still operate in the United States House of Representatives on the so-called Hastert rule, which means that you've got to pass a bill solely with Republican votes. And the problem is there's not enough unanimity among the caucus, and there won't be unanimity around the caucus. And the only way they'll ever be able to get a bill out, a meaningful bill that'll ever be enacted in law, is to do a compromise with the Democrats. And they refuse to do that. So the Democrats, as long as they operate under the rule that they're going to do it solely on Republican votes, only thing they do is sit back and say, you guys just go to it. And that's what they're doing.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that came up in this debate about what to do about the situation on the border currently, there was a point this week where Chuck Schumer came to the microphone and said, you know, we're not going to talk about legislation to fix this problem. The president can do that with a stroke of the pen. And yes, he can do things by executive order, which he did. But is that how we want our country governed? Do we want the legislative body to abdicate its responsibility to the executive branch and to executive order? And it raised a bigger question around that. So Democrats were saying, we're not going to do it. We're not going to step up. That doesn't get us any further down the road either.
True, Loretta, but there was nothing in the law that required this very drastic action to be taken and the way it was being enforced by breaking up families like this. And what happened, quite frankly, is to paraphrase Harry Truman, is Trump couldn't stand the heat, so he got out of the kitchen.
Right. And here's there are two things here. Number one, I mean, Democrats have offered a solution. They worked very closely with Republicans like Lindsey Graham and Susan Collins in February to put together a pretty darn good compromise bill that gave DACA their path to citizenship and included a substantial amount of money for the wall. They got to Trump, who was encouraging all this all along. We had forces in the White House kind of say they sabotaged that. And ever since, buddy, you're right. Democrats have seen no reason to help Republicans because they're not being offered anything. It's one of the curious things about Donald Trump is that, you know, this guy who made his fame with a book called Art of the Deal isn't, I mean, he continually tries to drive Democrats to a solution rather than trying to lure them to a solution. And Democrats are not in a polarized atmosphere that we've got right now. Democrats don't lose by that.
And it'll be interesting to see, you know, who this issue actually benefits in the midterms. I think Trump has some idea that this might benefit him by motivating his base to go out and vote. I think some polling came out about this issue of family separations either last week or earlier this week, and it showed that both Democrats and independents opposed this policy, or majorities of them did in the poll. But I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, a majority of Republicans, a slight majority, actually supported it. And so for the president, who may be looking at, you know, his path to stopping a blue wave in this upcoming midterm election as motivating his own base, this may be an issue where he doesn't actually look as bad as he does to Democrats and some independents.
And in fact, in Georgia, Kyle, we've got a situation where you Brian Kemp, who's in the primary runoff for governor, a Republican, he's bought $1 million worth of TV time between now and July 24th. But he launched his first ad this morning. He brought back Jake. And this time,
good old Jake.
Yeah, good old Jake. And this time he had the shotgun in properly unloaded and over his shoulder, not pointed at anybody.
We've got sound of that ad that we're going to play right now.
I'm Brian Kemp. You've heard about all my guns, my chainsaw, and my truck. Now career politician Casey Cagle is falsely attacking me. Why do you think that is, Jake?
Because you're a proud, hardcore Trump conservative on spending, immigration, and guns. Because Cagle's in a major corruption scandal and dropping like a rock in the polls?
You know what?
Sir.
You're starting to warm on me.
Yes, sir.
Brian Kemp, conservative for governor.
Okay, there's Brian Kemp's latest ad, Jim. Okay,
now take that first sentence that Jake had he is solidly with Trump on guns, immigration.
Yeah.
But immigration is the one that I'm interested in. Okay, this guy launches a 30-second spot that his race for governor depends on. Kind of right on the edge of the biggest immigration blow up that's affecting Washington and Republicans within the Trump presidency, let's put it that way. Okay, and he has made the calculation that that's not going to hurt him with a primary runoff voter, a Republican primary runoff voter, and I find that pretty amazing.
I do too, Jim. However, the point is that either he or Casey Cagle is going to be the Republican nominee, who will probably be, I didn't say would be, will probably be the next governor. So you've got to start imagining one of these people as being your governor, and is this what you want? Now, primary voters, as you know, are much smaller in number than runoff voters are much smaller in number than primary voters. So he's going to a hard, dedicated group of people that he's counting on coming out, who are all Trump people.
I would agree with that. You know, your runoff voter is going to be your most conservative voter, the ones that believe that, you know, tighten the border security, build the wall.
Tender age shelters don't bother them.
Well, you know, I would have to delineate, you know, that there is the issue of tighter security at the border and then separating of families. So, you know, that's a hard thing to accept, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, so there are a lot of Republicans that are not supportive of the separation of children and parents.
I totally agree with Loretta here. And frankly speaking, this whole issue was a manufactured issue. You know, somebody said, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And we didn't have a situation that needed this kind of fix. And this was just a blunder, in my opinion. I'm not sure whether it was Jeff Sessions or the Homeland Security Secretary, but somebody ought to be held accountable for this tragedy.
So I want to put a stop in this discussion for a moment, because we've got some developing news right now that involves Karen Handel. She is presiding on the House floor this afternoon, and Ted Lieu, who's a Democratic congressman from California, he tried to play some audio the investigative news site ProPublica published earlier this week from one of these detention centers of children crying. And Karen Handel was presiding on the floor, and apparently it was a pretty chaotic situation because she was trying to stop Ted Lieu from playing this audio, Jim.
Did she succeed? Do we know yet?
I don't know yet. I'm just looking at the traffic on Twitter, but we're hoping to get some audio of that exchange here, hopefully later in the program that
she was one of the supporters of the most conservative House immigration bill that was voted on yesterday.
Either way, she loses because you're up there presiding, and she's going to have to rule eventually what the parliamentarian tells her, which is you probably can't play that audio. And if she keeps them from playing the audio, then, in fact, that's going to be used against her, even though the House rules don't permit these things to be on TV. Somehow they always manage to get there.
Okay, let's take a short break here. We've got lots more to cover with ground on immigration. We're going to get back and talk about how that's going to factor into the governor's race and a whole lot of other stuff to talk about, as there is always. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. We'll be back after a short break.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported the station, and, well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind on GPB. We're talking today with Jim Galloway from the AJC, Republican strategist Loretta Lepore, former Congressman Buddy Darden, and Kyle Hayes, the host of the Peach Pod podcast. You can watch us just talking politics if listening on the radio isn't enough. We're at Politics GPB on Twitter and the Facebook live stream. Just search for GPB News on Facebook. You'll see it. You'll see me looking at my phone because I don't have a laptop computer anymore, so I have to bring this in here. But anyway, let's get back to this. And we were talking briefly about the governor's race and this new ad that Brian Kemp's released. Loretta, you're talking about how that plays well with Republican voters, but he's going to have, if Brian Kemp's the winner, he's going to have to pivot real quick from a situation where you're winning Republican voters into a general election where you're having to appeal to everybody.
That's right. It's not going to be a pivot. It's going to have to be a real long glide toward the center. And because he's pretty far out there to the right now. And, you know, on the other side, Stacey Abrams ran a primary race pretty far to the left, but she's got time right now to kind of move back more gradually toward the middle and talk about issues that are appealing across the spectrum. She's been out talking about education and so forth. And so, you know, that will be a shorter time frame for Brian. And depending on what happens between now and the runoff, you know, he could be staking a lot more ground between now and then.
Yeah, and of course, you've got also, we should mention, in the primary runoff, he's facing Casey Cagle, who is you've got this interesting contest going on over loyalty to Donald Trump. I just find fascinating.
Yeah, and that's popped up a couple of places this week, hasn't it?
It has, and it's just this remarkable measure of how the Republican Party is now almost wholly oriented, at least in its as an electioneering machine, it's wholly oriented and built around Donald Trump.
You're right. It's the Trump party.
It's interesting that that's happening now, because you think back to last year. You think back to some of these special elections where you had politicians that were trying to run in a Trump mold and weren't getting a lot of traction. But now you're in a situation where the identity of the party is that of the leader, where now it's like Republicans can't run to Trump fast enough.
Well, if you look at what happened with Mark Sanford in South Carolina, his district is a very conservative district, and he has been traditionally a very conservative legislator, voting with Donald Trump most of the time. His comments just have been, confrontational or questioning of the president. Today, I believe it was, the president came out and also supported Martha Roby, who's
right,
in jeopardy
Alabama.
In Alabama. And so she's in a runoff. And he hasn't come into that race because she, in the presidential race, had said she couldn't support him because
after the Access Hollywood
The Access Hollywood stuff. But he has said she's been a good person who has voted along with him on the Make America Great agenda. And that happened at the urging of Paul Ryan.
And he has probably seen some polls, Loretta, showing that Martha Roby is still popular in that district as well. As you know, her father is former Judge Jodis Dabena of the 11th Circuit, and the Roby Dabena family is quite well known and quite popular, and I think the president was quite wise not to get all the way too far out on that race because she has a very strong constituency on her own.
But what's to me what's interesting is just how granular this Trump loyalty stuff is getting. I mean, basically, you had the Kegel campaign send out a press release yesterday accusing Brian Kemp of being soft on Donald Trump
because he attended a event for no, I'm sorry,
no, this is right.
An event for Kasich, John Kasich, governor of Ohio, when he was running for president
in
Sandy Springs,
in 2015,
along with Karen Handel and Ralph Reed in 2015.
And John Kasich, of course, is now the kind of the Judas Iscariot of the Trump party. But also, they dug up an August 2016 article in the Athens Banner Herald that basically says, look, Brian has Secretary of State Brian Kemp, and the title is important, telling Athens Republicans, look, we went through the process. I know a lot of you aren't happy with the presidential candidate we've got, but we've got what we've got, and I think he's better than the Democratic alternative. That in a primary runoff is now not sufficiently Trump.
Well, and it was also just a couple of weeks ago that Casey Cagle called for Donald Trump to win the Nobel Peace Prize over the negotiations Trump had with Kim Jong-un. And now, just a couple of weeks later, a lot of the nation has been horrified by what some people are calling human rights abuses on the border. So it's been quite a swing.
I don't think there's any doubt that, of course, Republicans are strongly, even more strongly for Trump, and he has consolidated his base. But the real decisions are going to be made out there by those people in the middle, those people who don't consider themselves loyal Democrats or Republicans. And I'm interested in Loretta's take on how these people are being affected by what's going on, because that is the real political issue that's going to be decided in November.
Right.
So I don't know.
And I would say that I would think that's the majority of the people, even in Georgia. You know, when you look at, if you look at even the Democratic side and the Republican side, people that are more in the middle make up the majority than where both candidates started out or are at this point in time on the Republican side and the Democratic side. And so it's been a really difficult process for those in the middle and probably the real challenge here is getting those people to vote, right? So the challenge is not only the positions and moderating their positions, these candidates, as they go into the general election, but then getting all of those disaffected individuals in the middle to go to the polls. And so what's going to drive them to the polls? The down ticket races. Those races are just as important on this ticket as what's at the top of the ticket.
For the first time in my recollection, because usually it's been driven by the top places, the United States Senate and the governor and maybe the lieutenant governor. But now, all of a sudden, these down-ticket races like Secretary of State, Public Service Commission, and by the way, do you realize there's a Democratic statewide runoff coming up as well? Because we've got to find out who is going to be our nominee for the superintendent of schools in the state. So there will be Democrats an opportunity to vote in the Democratic primary. Won't be many, but there is a Democratic primary runoff as well as Republican runoff.
Well, speaking of the runoff, let's get back to Casey Cagle for a second. And Jim, your colleague, Bill Torpy, had an interesting interview this week with Clay Tippins.
Yeah, the fallout over this secret recording that happened on May 24th, when Clay Tippins walked into Casey Cagle's office to talk about endorsing him in post primary is it keeps trickling out there. I mean, it's so far we've heard maybe 9 minutes of a 90-minute conversation, and that one focused on why Casey Cagle ended up supporting a specific piece of education legislation. But my AJC friend Bill Torpy talked to Clay Tippins about why he did that, because I mean he didn't break any laws because Georgia is a one-party recording state. He had an iPhone in his pocket, hit record, and walked in and talked to Casey. That's not illegal under Georgia law. But in the state capitol, many people would think it crossed a very important line in terms of the confidential conversations that go on behind the scenes. And what to me, the best part of that interview, I encourage you to read the whole column, but the best part of it was Clay Tippins explaining how he applied his Navy SEAL training, that when he was taught hand-to-hand combat, it was drilled into him. If you're in a fight, don't fight fair. Win.
And it's a knife fight, it looks like to me. And in a knife fight, somebody's going to get cut.
Let's just hope they're not real cuts, though. That was the interesting thing to me about that, Jim, is he had quotes, Bill Turpie had quotes from Steve Henson, Democrat, talking mm-hmm. about, you know, it's not just necessarily a partisan thing. I mean, there are conversations that happen behind closed doors in the state capitol in Georgia and government offices all around the world.
Right, right. And now with the smartphone, everybody can be a fly on the wall whenever he or she wants to. And what's interesting to me about this whole incident is that I don't think the lieutenant governor understood that when this goes back to this education legislation where he kind of pushed Clay Tippins' uncle, Lindsey Tippins, a state senator, he pushed Lindsey Tippins to move a bill that he really didn't want to. And it became a point of honor with Lindsey Tippins. And the Tippinses are kind of one of those old Southern families where that means something. And I don't think the lieutenant governor understood that he was picking a family feud there.
Well, I've known Lindsey since 1970, even before. He was very supportive of me in my first campaign for district attorney in 1972. And to a Tippins, especially Lindsey Tippins, his word is his bond. Once he says something, that's how he feels about it, and he doesn't really care who knows. And so it's no surprise to us that Lindsey stuck by his guns against Casey Cagle when this issue came out. What I want to know is, what's Brian Kemp's position on the same legislation? Does he think it's also a lot of hooey, or does he think it's good legislation? Loretta?
I don't know. I haven't heard him be asked about it. So, to date.
He has criticized, his campaign has criticized Cagle, I mean, nonstop, simply for the kind of the ethical flexibility.
Well, and more about the comment that was at the crux of this, which was, this is about politics, not about policy.
Exactly, right. On the specifics of the legislation, I think he would probably actually support that, because it was there were two bills. One was for raising the amount of money that went to state charter schools from the state, and the other one was an increase in allowable scholarships. It was raising the cap on
tuition tax credit.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to go now. We have audio of this, what just happened on the House floor in Congress. Karen Handel presiding in the chamber as Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu tried to play some of the audio of these, some of the audio that these children in these detention centers in Texas. This was a 6-minute exchange, but we're just going to play a small part of it right now.
Why are we hiding this from the American people?
The Rule 17 prohibits the use of an electronic device to make sounds in the chamber.
Why are we hiding it from
the
American people?
The gentleman will suspend per Rule 17 of the House.
We have 2,300 babies and kids.
The gentleman will suspend per Rule 17 of the House that prohibits the use of a device to make sounds in the chamber.
We have 2,300 babies and kids in detention facilities.
So again, that is just a small part of this 6-minute back and forth that went on between Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu and Karen Handel, who is presiding over business on the House floor, Speaker Pro Tem. This afternoon, Jim.
You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of what happened last year in the aftermath of which shooting was this? Or was it Parkland? Was it Parkland, or was it the one in Florida when John Lewis and other House Democrats pretty much had a sit-in on the floor and began transmitting their remarks.
The House wasn't in session.
The House wasn't in session, and they began transmitting images via their cell phones, which, again, were
was against this
one particular rule. And I think what you've got now, you've got Democrats who have no power in the House. They're not near a majority yet, and they're pretty much locked out of legislation. They're breaking a few rules to get their point across.
Tom Faust, our producer, tells us that was 2 years ago today.
Ah, thank you. Oh.
I was presiding over the U.S. House back in 1984 when they started panning the chamber to show that there were nobody sitting in the audience while Gingrich and Trent Lott and other Republicans were calling on the other side to respond.
They were doing these special order speeches.
Special order speeches. That's correct. And all of a sudden, Tip had changed the rules. I didn't know the rules had been changed. And all of a sudden, people started running in and complaining about it. And I had to make a fairly difficult ruling. So I understand what Karen is going through right now.
I mean, we understand that, though, but this... I'm trying to find a way to ask this, Jim, because now Karen Handel is going to be injected into this debate in a way that she wasn't before.
Right.
Right.
And in a way she probably didn't want to be before, because this is not, you know, this is when you are in a, whether you're Democrat, whether you're Republican, if you're in a tight race, what you want to be, number one, you want to keep a low profile. You don't want to be the raised nail that gets hammered. And you want to be able to choose how you present yourself. Now she hasn't. That video is going to. It doesn't matter whether Lucy McBath or Kevin Abel win the primary runoff to face her in November. That video is going to be front and center, I think.
But as you know, the House rules prohibit that from being used in TV ads or other political ads. But I suspect
how do you prohibit that?
Right,
Kyle. I'm going to let you jump in here.
Yeah, I think. It sort of adds Karen Handel to the two Republican representatives that I think may be vulnerable this fall if this becomes an issue in her race. The person that I've been watching is Rob Woodall, because his district, I think, is a little bit more competitive. And there are down ballot races in his district where down ballot candidates are going to be working on getting out the vote in more diverse areas of the district. And I think this is an issue on immigration and on how tough this issue is for viewers and voters, one that he's going to have to answer on. And to this point, he was not among the group that was signing the discharge petition, the push from moderate Republicans in the House to try to force this issue onto House Speaker Paul Ryan with the help of Democrats. He is closer to the conservative flank on this one. And so it's going to be an issue for him, I think, a little bit more than her, but it definitely puts her in the mix on this issue now.
But Kyle, what he has wisely done, Rob Woodall, that is, has wisely done, is kept his head below the bullets. And he's been very, very non-controversial in that area, even though he's voted perhaps against what some of these people would have him vote. Still, he hasn't been visibly and very strongly out there.
Well that is one thing that I think progressives want to see in these races is candidates speaking out on these issues. And so it'll be interesting to see if they force him to not be able to take as low a profile.
Well, when you're looking at, you know, the Cook Report, for example, that analyzes these races.
And they come up with partisan indexes showing how.
Exactly. And they're nonpartisan and third party. They have Karen Handel in more jeopardy than Rob Woodall. And some of that has to do with the changing dynamics of the district itself, the geography of the district. And so Karen has heretofore been very careful about threading the needle in her district. You know, we've talked about this where she's taken a different approach on tariffs than the president, and I suspect not wanting to have to engage in this conversation so soon. So when she comes home, even though if we're not in the general election, these may begin to be things that are posed to her when she would rather not have to discuss any real hard questions until the general.
Right, and this tariff issue just jumped up again this morning and could force her to come out a little bit harder than she has on that particular issue much sooner than she wants to.
Mercedes-Benz U.S. headquarters is in her district.
Right. And you had a yet another morning tweet from Donald Trump saying that he is considering a 20% tariff on car imports from the European Union.
She could say what David Perdue said this morning on our sister station. He could say, I'm against tariffs, but I support the president.
And just to summarize what Buddy said there, David Perdue had an interview on WABE this morning. Tariffs was one of the things he talked about, which was interesting because he was jumping through some rhetorical hoops, I felt, Jim, with that question. Yes, he doesn't support tariffs, but he supports the president.
Right.
Can you do those two things with an issue like this?
Well, as long as Congress decides it's not going to force a confrontation with the president on tariffs, because it's wholly within Congress's power to put a leash on these national security issues that he's attaching to the tariffs that allow him to act unilaterally. So there's that. But you've got on this tariff issue, Bradley, you do have the Mercedes-Benz North American headquarters in Sandy Springs. You have the Porsche North American headquarters on the edge of Hartsfield-Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you've also got the Port of Brunswick, which is
where a lot of these cars
it's the hottest port, hottest U.S. port when it comes to foreign car imports.
They've got exports.
They've got 20,000 imported cars on their lot at any time.
And of course, we have a Kia plant in Georgia, and we have a BMW plant in South Carolina. So you've got far.
And a lot of the suppliers for those and for the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga are in Georgia.
Right. And what you've got is you had Donald Trump in Duluth, Minnesota earlier this week, and he was talking about his steel and aluminum tariffs, and it goes over well right there because Minnesota is a mining state. They have minerals to get out of the ground. They like that stuff. But that's old economy. The South is new economy, and it's got an auto system that's built on shifting parts and cars all around.
Have anybody kept up with the fact that former Governor Tim Pawlenty is running again up in Minnesota to become a governor again? And all of a sudden, a very, very popular former governor, Tim Pawlenty, is in serious jeopardy because he's not Trump enough in the state of Minnesota.
Kyle, any thoughts on trade?
The interesting thing I think about this trade issue is that the retaliation from other countries, some of our allies in Europe and in China, they're targeted towards products that are either made or consumed by people who are Republicans and people who would typically support Republican candidates. And so I think it broadening outside of Georgia a little bit, I think this may be an issue where it's an interesting test of is Trump sort of a cult of personality and they'll stick with him no matter what, or once something that Trump does affects voters in their pocketbooks, will they start to rethink that? And will their rethinking that maybe if it just means that they don't show up in the polls, that could be a drag on them in the midterms too?
If you're going to study that, Kyle, I would nominate the Harley-Davidson demographic.
And the Kentucky bourbon demographic.
Well, it's a good point because, right, tariffs become taxes in some senses, and who pays the price? The consumer pays the price. And so when that does begin to impact consumers, how will that change attitude and in specific items that some of these trading partners have chosen to put tariffs on, like bourbon in Kentucky, for example. We'll see how that all plays out. I saw today that Turkey actually imposed tariffs on the U.S. in lieu of this, in response and retaliation to the aluminum tariff.
And I'm so glad you mentioned Turkey. Just briefly, we want to mention this weekend in Turkey, big election for president and for parliament as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan tries to consolidate his hold on power. Though the interesting thing about this election to me, I don't know if any of you have been following it, but the opposition parties in Turkey, which had been so fractured for a long time, have actually done a good job of running a coordinated campaign. And there's a very good chance that Recep Erdogan could either lose his parliamentary majority. He could lose his office as president, or he could lose both, or he could be very, very close. Watch the space.
Or it could turn into another alleged attempted coup. Mm-hmm. that could shake us all up.
We'll see. We will leave this here for now. We're going to take another short break, and we will return in just a moment here on GPP.
I'm Ira Flatow, live from Chicago this week on Science Friday, the midnight meteorite that took the Chicago suburbs by storm. The Science Friday players recreate the 2003 meteor shower, a SciArts play you're not going to want to miss. And we'll look at the thousands of coyotes that call Chicago home, why there's no need to be afraid. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 on GPB.
This is Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George. In for Bill Nygut, we're talking today with Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Loretta Lepore, Buddy Darden, and Kyle Hayes. Jim, we might perhaps maybe get some kind of resolution in the Water Wars dispute. The Supreme Court is set to issue a decision in Florida v. Georgia sometime next week.
Well, I would say set to may be the wrong word. It's running out of Mondays in its term,
and well, and then they keep adding days too because they keep putting off some of these decisions.
And I think Monday is the last one in June.
I think they're going to do a Tuesday session.
Yeah, okay, so. And so it's on a short list of maybe four huge issues that are out there. And so you're going to have you've got governors in three states who are just on pins and needles right now.
But you can't resolve that issue without bringing the Corps of Engineers in, because the Corps of Engineers, who happen to be a division of the United States government and supposedly immune here, they have their hand on the lever that controls the amount of water that goes from one state to another. So that's going to be an interesting thing to me, is to see to what extent they bring in the Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, and the ironic context here is that it's happening in probably the rainiest season that we've had in Georgia in years.
At full pool for the first time
They had to call off swimming and canoeing in the Chattahoochee because they were dumping too much water out of Lake Lanier.
It's about 3 feet over full pool the last time I checked. It might have gone down some, but it's just been absolutely amazing. Some of you probably know is that my firm and I represented Georgia for a number of years, beginning with the Barnes administration and through about half of the administration of Governor Deal. And it kept overhead paid for a long time in the firm, and we were pleased and honored to be representing the state of Georgia, and also we were compensated quite well, but apparently not quite as well as they're being compensated these days.
You've got just yesterday Governor Deal added another
million dollars.
Yeah.
to the 29 and a half is the figure I've got.
Yeah.
And you have to know that Florida is paying about the same rate.
They're paying more, as I recall.
So what could be the possible outcomes here?
Well, if you side with Georgia, I believe Georgia is kind of allied with the U.S. Corps on this, is it not?
They would
hope that the Supreme Court upholds the right of the Corps to make the decision that it's made to grant the city of Atlanta and its environs the water they need to keep growing, or the Supreme Court could stand up for those mussels over on the Florida Panhandle.
Appalachicola.
Or they could send it back to the special master for additional findings not inconsistent with their opinion, I believe is the way they say it, and it could just continue to prolong it. But
and given what it's done on the court has done on some pretty big issues in the last 2-3 weeks, that's not out of the realm of possibility.
That's correct. I don't foresee an end coming in the next week or so, whatever the decision is that the United States Supreme Court makes.
Kyle?
Well, I guess the interesting thing about the timing about the ruling is that it's going to land in the middle of governor's races in both states, and it may be unclear what either Florida or Georgia are going to have to do to comply with the ruling and what the economic impacts would be, either for those mussels or for water use in the metro Atlanta area. And so that may become campaign fodder between the candidates in Georgia and down in Florida as to who would manage that transition and in a implementing that ruling the best.
Yeah, this is not something I've heard so far from many of the
candidates. But I haven't heard any of the gubernatorial candidates on this. But I would be very interested to see if there's any difference, in the reaction to between Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp, because Brian Kemp has made some interesting noises about economic development in Georgia, that more and more of it needs to be moved outside of Metro Atlanta and into other parts of Georgia. And if this this ruling goes against the state, against Metro Atlanta, that could be one part of the reaction.
It's amazing how people talk about downstream, about it being only Atlanta. But when we say Metro Atlanta, we're talking going as far north as Gainesville and right. as far yeah, south yeah. as New London.
Yeah, you're talking North
County.
Georgia. You're talking North Georgia.
Exactly, Jim. You're talking North Georgia, not just the city of Atlanta.
Okay, so moving on, Senators Johnny Isakson and David Perdue are quite angry at their Republican colleague, Jeff Flake, because he is threatening to hold up some judicial appointments over Trump's decisions in regards to sort of closing the door a little bit with Cuba, that door that President Obama opened when he normalized relations a couple of years back. Trump's reversed Obama's policy that sort of gives Americans free reins to travel in Cuba. And this decision's having some effects in Georgia with somebody who President Trump nominated to the bench here. Jim.
I'm going to let Buddy explain this one because he's the expert here.
Sure. I won't say I'm the expert, but it's a fairly simple matter. Really, the president has nominated an extremely well-qualified young woman, Britt Grant, from the Georgia Supreme Court to be our next 11th Circuit judge. And she will be confirmed. It's a question of matter about when. Now, they want it done yesterday or tomorrow, but at the same time, Justice Grant has just been reelected for another six-year term, which doesn't start until January. And that might be some temporary inconvenience, and I regret
But she's got health insurance. She's got health insurance.
She has a job.
She's got a job. And there's no question she's going to be confirmed. It might be a couple of months, and they're using it, I think, to maybe tweak the president, not to tweak David Perdue or Johnny Isakson, our union senators, but they're using it just as a little mechanism just to try to get to Trump. And in my view, it's a tempest in a teapot that's not going anywhere. I was a little surprised, frankly, how vociferously both of them have reacted to one senator doing it, because they do it to each other all the time. That's Judge Billy Ray, who's being held up. He's been held up now about 6 months or so.
And I believe David Perdue held up, it's blocked, Dax Lopez, did he not?
Yes.
Yes.
He blackballed him in essence. So while I think we could not have a better nominee by this president, by anybody for this job, and I think that Justice Grant will do a great job. I think in time it'll work itself out.
Well, you're talking about how angry both Isakson and Perdue are. Isakson says he actually confronted Jeff Flake about this. I don't know what confront means, but there you go.
In Johnny Isakson language, that's still a fairly quiet quiet thing. I'm surprised that he actually, but I tell you what, it's a measure of how ticked off he is that he even mentioned that he talked to Jeff Flake about it.
I would agree with that. He's a very tempered individual. So any comment would really be a reflection of his discontent with this decision making. But I will say, Lisa Branch, who was just sworn into the 11th Circuit, coming off the state appellate court. I mean, her nomination was drawn out from committee to go to the floor to get approved by the Senate, so much so that over the Christmas holiday, she had to be renominated coming back in by the president to then get through the Senate, go back to the floor again, finally get approved. So these things can be protracted. It's very unfortunate that our members of Congress are tying up our judicial appointees in this fashion.
Bradley, as a practical matter, the de facto appointment, though, is made by the senators from that area themselves.
Right.
And that's what really, I think, gets to Isakson and gets to Perdue, is that this is the person that they selected. And incidentally, I've got to give them high marks, because every single judge that has been selected at the district level and the appeals court level, I think, have been sterling and outstanding people. And so I think they regard it as an affront to them personally, since they nominated Justice Grant, more than to the president.
Let me ask you, Buddy, in these cases, I mean, did Jeff Flake go to these, go to Isaacson and Purdue and let him and let them know that he was holding it? Or was it a secret that had to be dug out?
Well, more of a secret had to be dug out because he postponed it in committee and opposed it coming up. And in the Judiciary Committee, the votes are 11 to 10. So anytime one member of the majority expresses a problem, they just sit there and hold it. They just kick the can on down the road, and that's what they did with Judge Grant. She's not in any trouble. She had an outstanding hearing, but they're just kicking the can down the road a little bit, like the Senate always does.
All right. So in our last couple of minutes here, the Democrats are trying to decide where they're going to hold their 2020 convention. Mm-hmm. It's going to be Houston, Miami Beach, Milwaukee, and Denver. There was a longer list of finalists. Atlanta's name was on that
they were
list.
They were on the list of eight, but they're not on the list of four.
Thank goodness. We're still recovering from 1988. And okay. So we've had our convention. We don't want another one.
Well, I think President Dukakis did really well in 88. Don't you think so?
But I guess it also gets to this thing as well. For a long time, these conventions have just, they've basically been showcases for the party. They're not, they don't serve the purpose that they did 30, 40, 50 years ago, right? So what does a 20, I'm just trying to imagine, what does a 2020 Democratic convention in the age of Trump look like?
Number one, they're looking at places where they may be able to juice the vote a little bit in November 2020. And that's why, you know, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, there's one. Colorado, that's another one. You know, I'd be a little bit more skeptical of Texas, but Florida is definitely a swing state. And then the other thing you have to look at is that this one is going to be in July. It's not going to be in August. It's not going to be in September. Because it's an Olympic year, you have to choose whether to go before or after the Olympics. You don't want to have your meeting during the Olympics. So Democrats are taking a chance. They're going to go before the Olympics.
And didn't we lose Wisconsin this past time?
Yep.
That's what I thought.
You mean Democrats, or you mean yes. Hillary Clinton yes. lost Wisconsin?
Democrats.
She did,
yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kyle? And it was interesting. I wondered when Atlanta was on the list, when Birmingham was on the list, and Houston appears to have made it through in the next round. I wondered if there was a specific Democrat in mind that Democrats might want to highlight, a rising star. Stacey Abrams from Georgia might be one of those if it had come to Atlanta. But with Houston still on the list, if Beto O'Rourke can upset Ted Cruz in that Senate race, and in the midst of the immigration mess, Ted Cruz looked a little bit more urgently on the issue of child separation than I think you might have assumed he would have if he was safe. So he might be looking at some polling that shows that race is closer than you might think. And that, if he could pull that upset, may put Beto O'Rourke in a position to be kind of a featured rising star of a 2020 convention
and,
on top of the celebration of the candidate.
And Democrats have talked so long about changing demographics in Texas and that would be their salvation in that state. And so far that hasn't been the case, right?
No, but if you wanted to keep a focus, if you thought that the immigration issue was a good one for you, and you wanted to keep a focus on it, then Houston's not a bad choice.
Kyle,
well, and they were also more competitive, I believe. Georgia was closer in the final result than Ohio was in 2016, and Texas was closer to a Hillary Clinton victory than Iowa was. So I think some of that polling has moved back as some of support for Trump in the Midwest has shrank. But demographics are pushing Democrats closer to being competitive in some of those states. I think it just depends on the specific race and the specific candidate on whether or not they could actually flip one of those in 2020.
Loretta, you have any thoughts here?
Nothing that hasn't really been iterated already. I mean, these events, they're massive.
Yeah.
and you know, there's pluses and minuses of hosting them. And
covering them, it has become just a tortuous event. I recommend watching, tuning in from TV.
I do, too. Right, it's right. A media event and a trade show now. Nothing's really decided.
All right. Thank you so much, Buddy Darden, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway, Kyle Hayes. And thank you for listening to Political Rewind Friday. We'll be back with you Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Hope you'll join us then. I'm Bradley George. Thanks so much for listening.